reading executive committee minutes from wartime.
Okay.
It looks darker, that's why I'm, is it set?
It's the same.
Okay, sorry.
Tell me a little bit about your own personal goals when you came on the faculty and your involvement in the establishment of the first renal dialysis unit at the School of Medicine.
Well, I joined the faculty with an interest in metabolism and endocrinology, and as I said a little earlier, Dr. Glenn Irwin was sort of the role model I was following. And an opportunity came up for us to acquire an artificial kidney and to begin a hemodialysis program. I hadn't had too much interest in nephrology up until that time, but then Dr. Robert Faley and I were asked to go to Boston, to Peter Ben Brigham Hospital, to visit the laboratory of John Merrill and to kind of make an assessment about whether or not we should proceed along these lines. And when I saw the kinds of things that John Merrill and his group were doing, then I had a great desire to try and set up an artificial kidney laboratory and a service. We concerned ourselves initially primarily with patients with acute renal failure. And in the early stages of hemodialysis, it was felt that a physician should be in attendance throughout the entire procedure, so that with a very small group of us doing this, we spent many, many hours out here treating patients. Dr. Hunter Soper and myself were most actively involved. The activity was very demanding, and I think that by the time that I got ready to join the dean's office, I was happy to see the increased interest in dialysis and what could be done in chronic dialysis, which was then largely taken up by Dr. Stuart Cleet, and the program blossomed under his direction.
Yeah, I understand it was even very difficult to set it up every time before a patient to come in, and then the time involved afterwards. It's very intensive.
It took a lot of time. The patients were usually very ill and frequently had other kinds of associated illness which had precipitated the renal failure. So it was hard work, but when we were successful, it was most gratifying.
Following Dr. J.O. Ritchie's retirement, Dr. Bill Kirby briefly served as chairman of the Department of Medicine. Can you comment on the transition from volunteer to full-time chairmanship within the department?
Well, I'm sure that with Dr. Ritchie's retirement, Dr. Van Nies knew that with the success which Dr. Harry Shoemaker had had in stimulating growth and productivity of the surgery department, and what Dr. Neuenberger had accomplished beginning in psychiatry, that he knew that we needed a full-time chairman who had an interest in establishing a research program within the Department of Medicine. Dr. Kirby was a very renowned internist and known for his research work in infectious diseases. He was recruited and appointed, I think, in 1957, And he arrived, and he was an intense individual who was dedicated to initiating a research program quickly and very effectively. My recollection is that Mrs. Kirby was not eager to leave the state of Washington, and they had not purchased a house in Indiana. Dr. Kirby, in his intense desire to get on with the project, didn't think that we Hoosiers moved at a pace that was as fast as it should be, and I think became somewhat despondent and discouraged by what he felt was not a rapid enough evolution. And after some 6 or 7 or 8 months, I think was so discouraged and so despondent that he opted to ask to leave, and I believe it was done under good circumstances.
We'll move on to the dean's office. I wanted you to go into describing your role in implementing the statewide medical education system, the steps toward that, and then we'll talk about the importance later.
Okay. Well, first of all, in early 1964, there was a commission appointed. No, there wasn't. It was not a commission. For some reason or another, the governor of the state of Indiana commissioned Booz Allen and Hamilton to do a study of what Indiana needed to do to respond to the patient care needs of the state and for medical education. This came about because, like you've heard, Dean Van Ease had early in the 1960s indicated there were problems of a brain drain and other kinds of problems. So that in 1964, Booz Allen and Hamilton started their study. And they reported their final report to then Governor Welch in December of 1964. And it's an interesting study, and people need to look back at it. They pointed out that yes, there was a brain drain. Yes, we had too few physicians. Yes, the mix by geography and specialty wasn't too good. They also pointed out that Indiana, with its one medical school, was doing a pretty good job in increasing the number of students admitted, although there were great needs faculty and facilities-wise. They also pointed out something that some people will occasionally forget. At the time, our graduating senior class had more people in it than there were internships in the state of Indiana. There were very few residencies, and most of those were here in Indianapolis. So they made the point that we needed a increase in the number of students. We needed to bring up our facilities and our faculty to meet current obligations to students. And most importantly, they pointed out that if you're going to increase the number of students and graduates, in order to help retain your graduates, you're going to have more and better residencies scattered throughout the state. Well, there are other part of the plans, and I'm not going to go into it. They talked about a medical university with 100% increase in the student body. And there was disappointment in many communities in Indiana who had hoped that they would be the site of the second or third medical school. So Dean Irwin, in the spring of 1964, appointed a faculty committee which included people such as Harry Shoemaker, John Hickam, Lyman Meeks, Dave Gibson, John Mahoney, Al Levine, Jim Ashmore, there may have been others, and myself as chairman, and charged us with looking at what the problems were and what should be done. At the same time, the Council on Curricular Affairs was appointed. It was appointed a little bit later on, but it was appointed under the direction of Dr. Bill Dice and Dr. Ed Tyler. Dean Irwin appointed that council, and they were studying the curriculum. Our committee finally it gave its report, I think, about in the summer of 1965. I'm not sure of the exact time. And we confirmed that the findings, which Booz Allen Hamilton had pointed out, were in fact there. We found that there was a brain drain. We were educating a reasonable number of students, but that the retention rate and the attraction of other graduates wasn't what it should be. And we projected a need to increase the size of the entering class. We also recognized that the mix of undergraduate medical education, internship and residency, and continuing medical education could be very important, and if we had it in multiple areas, we might enhance the coming into and staying in the system. At any rate, while we were completing our studies, we made our report, and we suggested what is what we call the Indiana Statewide Plan for Medical Education, which was a decentralized system. It was a system involving multiple institutions of higher education, hospitals scattered about. It involved the practicing community, and it had as its core the Indiana University School of Medicine with the resources available here. We thought that this should be interconnected with a wonderful biomedical communication network. Our plan was then studied by a state legislative commission, which was chaired by Dr. Walter Benneville. And Dr. Benneville was a chiropractor from Jeffersonville, Indiana, and they recommended that we go ahead with what I'll call phase one. That one, we strengthen graduate medical education and expand graduate medical education, internship and residencies. That we strengthen and improve continuing medical education. That we be part of a statewide telecommunication network called SUTCC system, now known as IHETS. And that these were the major recommendations. There were four dissenting opinions with this, and all of them recommended a school in Fort Wayne, in Lake County, in Muncie, in Evansville. The state legislature passed what was called Senate Bill, I think 356 or some such number, and they did start to support continuing medical education and graduate medical education and the statewide telecommunication network. this was a major undertaking. So we knew that that was phase one. Well, in 1965, they did that. In 1966, Dr. Hickam and I worked together, and we prepared a grant called the Regional Medical Program Grant, Heart Cancer Stroke Grant, built on the same concept that was in the Indiana Statewide Medical Education Plan. This allowed us to get some funds to help develop the program too. Dr. Irwin asked me to join the Dean's office, which I did, I think, in 1966. That gave me the opportunity to help in the development and implementation of the statewide plan with the regional medical programs plan. We found Dean Behring, it wasn't Dean then, Dr. Behring was recruited, and he became vitally involved in with this whole effort also, so that we had enough success that a later commission initiated phase two. Now, I want to point out that the model that we had seen on the Bloomington campus, where we had a medical education program and it was part of our, was important to us. In 1968, John Mahoney and myself negotiated with Purdue University and Notre Dame University that we would have entering medical students on their campus that year, so that in 1968, we had medical students entering on four different campuses. And while there was much skepticism originally, we did show that you could provide a reasonable educational experience in multiple areas in a decentralized way. At the same time, I became very much involved with what was called SUTCC. In fact, I think I chaired their State University Telecommunication Council for maybe 10, 15 years, something like that. So in 1971 or 72, I think it was 1971, phase two of the statewide plan was enacted, and from that point forward, we saw the development of the Centers for Medical Education. That might be of interest to some people that originally it was felt that the students, we changed our curriculum, I'll come back to that, but originally it was felt that you couldn't have a second year program in these locations because there was concern about a course which was known as Introduction to Clinical Medicine, which is part of the second year transition course from the basic science to clinical science. So, for a while, even from Bloomington, we bused the second year students up here so they could get physical diagnosis on our campus. The Fort Wayne campus had physician's assistance programs until 1981. Nevertheless, the program was initiated. It was a success. It was tied in with our statewide plan on graduate medical education. The Council on Curricular Affairs, which was simultaneously going on, adopted rather modestly in 1967 the ultimate curriculum. And the ultimate curriculum had some features in it that had to be wedded with the statewide plan. So my role within the dean's office was largely I was involved with kind of having been in a number of these things. I was an assist in trying to work out the various relationships so that we could develop and initiate educational programs in multiple locations. That's essentially it.
What has been the lasting importance of the statewide medical education system?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, there has been a marked increase in the number of physicians, and there's been a lot of different kinds of physicians with different skills and all, which are available in many fine hospitals throughout the state of Indiana. I think the statewide plan has helped to identify students from those areas who have had an opportunity to go back for graduate medical education and to stay in those areas. Probably one of the biggest and most important things about this whole effort is that we have documented, and our accreditation success has shown, that you can have quality medical educational programs in multiple areas. And so I think that it's been a great success. In my view, it has the potential for expansion and reduction in size without doing a whole lot of harm. So I think that's another plus.
When was the second year implemented, and how did that come about?
Well, for a while, the Bloomington program had second year students before some of the other programs did. And Dr. Roy Behnke was the director of the Introduction to Clinical Medicine, and it's a very important course, and he had the feeling that there just wasn't the requisite manpower and human resources and facilities to do this in another area. And so we would bring students up from Bloomington for that experience. A young internist at that time, Dr. Bob Robinson, was on the Bloomington campus. He had been a resident in our Department of Internal Medicine. He was filled with enthusiasm, and husbanded the resources in people and facilities and financial support that they could start it. And it was started as a pilot program on the Bloomington program, was carried out successfully, and after that was demonstrated, then the centers came online. I forget what year that occurred, but I would guess it was mid-80s.
Step back and just talk a little bit about the ultimate curriculum. You talked about curricular unrest at one point during our conversation. How did that come about? And tell me a little bit more about the ultimate curriculum. It is funny they called it that.
Well, acting dean John Nuremberger in 1964 appointed the Council of Clinical Curricular Affairs, wanted to look at our curriculum, and they did a year's study, and they came up with the findings that the students were spending too much time in class, didactic lectures, that they were not getting to the patients at a very early point in their career, that the third year was a reasonable clinical year, but the fourth year frequently was a rehash of the third year. The students were unhappy, the faculty was overworked, and it was thought that there was a need to now take a look and plan what should be done to meet future needs. And we're at a time where there's technology development coming online. There are a variety of kinds of things with video, computer, library, lots of exciting things happen. It's an exciting time research-wise. So Dean Irwin then, after he appointed the our committee in May, and I think in September, he then appointed the Council on Curricular Affairs. And they held a whole series of faculty retreats. And they were, they finally agreed that there were certain things that needed to be done. One, to reduce the number of classroom hours and lecture time. They thought it was excessive, and sometimes there was very poor planning between departments. Secondly, they thought that you should get to the patients earlier, and that there needed to be a sort of a course to prepare students for medicine on the wards, and so that became the introduction to clinical medicine. We run out of time. Third, they found that the students, if they had a core bit of clinical knowledge, could help plan their fourth year, and they thought the fourth year ought to be largely elective, and it ought to be a mix of sort of a return to basic science and some clinical electives, so it could begin to prepare the students to be responsible for planning and continuing their own sort of lifelong learning habits. And this took a number of faculty retreats and to come about. Nevertheless, the final Phase 4 Council of Curricular Affairs report did, like I say, come up with their modest ultimate curriculum, and those were some of the essentials. The electives fit in well with our statewide plan, and identifying a core of information needed for students also gave us some sort of a goal to work with as we set up the decentralized educational system.
Ready for the next tape?
Yeah. A few more things.
No. You're doing okay. Great. We have just a little bit more. Tell me a little bit about the importance of telecommunications.
Number 10.
During your long tenure as chairman of the admissions committee, what changes have you seen in admissions policies During your long tenure as chairman of the admissions committee, what changes have you seen in admissions policies and in the population applying to medical school?
Good. Right one you added. Tell me a little bit about curricular unrest and the ultimate curriculum.
Tell me a little bit about curricular unrest and the ultimate curriculum.
Okay.
tell me a little bit about curricular unrest and the ultimate curriculum.
I'm not hearing, tell me a little. I'm hearing tell me a little.
Okay. Tell me a little bit about the curricular unrest and the ultimate curriculum.
When you added, one of the things you want to talk about was the age of the medical student.
One of the things you wanted to talk about was the age of the medical student.
That's it.
Okay, we still got time. Can we redo that one that I was just talking about?
The little bit?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I didn't like that either.
Okay.
Tell me a little bit about the curricular unrest you referred to a little bit ago, and about the ultimate.
I'm saying a little bit twice.
Okay.
Okay, one more time.
Can you tell me a little bit about the curricular unrest that was going on in the early 1960s and about the ultimate curriculum that resulted?